This is April 27th, 2008, and today I'm going to look at memory, the function of memory as it relates to practice. And I'm going to start by reading from a chapter in a book called The Botany of Desire. This is a book, one of the books by Michael Pollan. He's written quite a bit now about gardening and diet. He's been widely published in The New Yorker, and as well as his books. This book was just fascinating. I highly recommend it to anyone. What he does is, and this is The Botany of Desire, he looks at how the fate of plants are entwined with human desires, hence the title. And he takes just four plants, one chapter for each, and as examples of how that which we place great value in serves the interests of the plant, and vice versa. So the four plants are the apple, and he takes this as an example of how our human desire for sweetness has served the apple very well. The tulip for beauty, the potato for control. He talks, he really focuses on bioengineering. And then lastly, marijuana for intoxication, the human desire for intoxication. It's the longest of the four chapters. And in it, he gets into consciousness and our yearning to alter our consciousness. He went about the study of cannabis, it seems, with quite a bit of gusto. He tried growing some. He spent time in Amsterdam. It seems to be the marijuana capital of the world. I learned a lot about marijuana from this chapter and how it's changed from when I was much younger. But I'm just going to read pieces of this chapter as it relates to practice and memory. So he poses the question, what exactly does it mean biologically to say a person is high? And then he got one answer he got from a neuroscientist by the name of Alan Howlett was cognitive dysfunction. And this struck him as awfully parched kind of response. But he then found that there was something to it. And he got the same sort of response from another neuroscientist. And he said, so there it seemed the neuroscientist had stranded me, all on my unscientific own, with a dime bag and the dubious company of poets such as Allen Ginsberg and Charles Baudelaire, Fitzhugh Ludlow, and, yikes, Carl Sagan. He cites a little essay by Carl Sagan that reveals that Sagan himself found a lot of value in it. And then he says, I've come to think that a cognitive dysfunction of a very special kind does in fact lie at the heart of it. The scientists I spoke to were unanimous in citing short-term memory loss as one of the key neurological effects of the cannabinoids. Cannabinoids are chemicals in the brain that cause just that. Help us edit out what we don't need to retain in our memory. In their own way, so were the poets who tried to describe the experience of cannabis intoxication. All talk about the difficulty of reconstructing what happened mere seconds ago, and what a Herculean challenge it becomes to follow the thread of a conversation or a passage of prose when one's short-term memory isn't operating normally. And yet the scientists said that the THC in cannabis, that's the active ingredient that has this effect, the THC in cannabis is only mimicking the actions of the brain's own cannabinoids. What a curious thing this is for a brain to do, to manufacture a chemical that interferes with its own ability to make memories. And not just memories of pain either. So he emailed someone, I'm afraid I don't know who this is, it was mentioned earlier in the chapter that I didn't photocopy, Raphael Meshulam, to ask him why he thought the brain might secrete a chemical that has such an undesirable effect. And he said, "Don't be so sure that forgetting is undesirable. Do you really want to remember all the faces you saw on the New York City subway this morning?" Meshulam's somewhat oblique comment helped me to begin to appreciate that forgetting is vastly underrated as a mental operation. Indeed, that it is a mental operation, rather than, as I'd always assumed, strictly the breakdown of one. Yes, forgetting can be a curse, especially as we age. But forgetting is also one of the more important things healthy brains do, almost as important as remembering. Think how quickly the sheer volume and multiplicity of sensory information we receive every waking minute would overwhelm our consciousness if we couldn't quickly forget a great deal more of it than we remember. And then he goes through this little exercise. He's sitting at his keyboard and walks us through what it would be like. And he says, "At any given moment, my senses present to my consciousness, that is this perceiving eye, a blizzard of data no human mind can completely absorb." To illustrate the point, let me try to capture here a few drops of this perceptual cataract. Preserve one cross-section of the routinely forgotten. Right now, my eyes, even without moving, offer the following. Directly in front of me, the words I'm typing on a computer screen, along with its blue background and tumble of icons. Peripherally, there's the blonde wood grain of my desk, a mouse pad printed with words and images, a CD spinning red in its little window, two bookshelves crammed with a couple of dozen spines I could easily read, but don't. A gray plastic heater grate, a blue folder entitled Pot Clips, stuck into a standing file at an annoying angle, two hands with an unspecified number of flying fingers, Band-Aid on one hand, glint of gold on the other, one jeans-clad lap, two green-sweatered wrists, a window, its green something framing a boulder with lichen, dozens of trees, hundreds of branches, millions of leaves, and, drawing a soft border around 90% of this visual field, the metal frames of my eyeglasses. And that's just my eyes. We can appreciate here, if we don't already, the value of keeping the eyes down in Sesshin or any time in the Zendo. It just drastically reduces the number of visual perceptions, which almost inevitably spawn thoughts. And that's just my eyes. My sense of touch, meanwhile, presents, he goes through the same with touch, sound. And then he says, we'll all appreciate this one. I won't even try to catalog the numberless errant thoughts presently nipping around the writing of this paragraph like a flittering school of fish. And then he says in parentheses, or maybe I will. Second thoughts and misgivings arriving in waves, shoving crowds of alternative words and grammatical constructions, shimmering lunch options, small black holes of consciousness from which I try to fish out metaphors, a clamoring handful of to-dos, a spongy awareness of the time till lunch, and so on and so on. Well, that's... Can anyone relate to that? Actually, you know, the truth is that for most people, this doesn't reach a level of awareness. Most people in the world, it takes practice. It takes an awareness practice, meditation, to come into an awareness of this kind of din in the mind. It's not until we become aware of this noise in the mind that we can choose to not pursue it, not grasp at it. So long as we're not aware of it, we're just completely caught up in it. And then he goes on, our mental health depends on a mechanism for editing the moment-by-moment ocean of sensory data flowing into our consciousness down to a manageable trickle of the noticed and remembered. The cannabinoid network appears to be part of that mechanism, vigilantly sifting the vast chaff of sense impression from the kernels of perception we need to remember if we're to get through the day and get done what needs to be done. Much depends on forgetting. He goes on, the THC in marijuana and the brain's endogenous cannabinoids work in much the same way, but THC is far stronger and more persistent than anandamide, which, like most neurotransmitters, is designed to break down very soon after its release. What this suggests is that smoking marijuana may overstimulate the brain's built-in forgetting faculty, exaggerating its normal operations. This is no small thing. Indeed, I would venture that more than any other single quality, it is the relentless moment-by-moment forgetting. This draining of the pool of sense impression almost as quickly as it fills, that gives the experience of consciousness under marijuana its peculiar texture. It helps account for the sharpening of sensory perceptions, for the aura of profundity in which cannabis bathes the most ordinary insights, and, perhaps most important of all, for the sense that time has slowed or even stopped. For it is only by forgetting that we ever really drop the thread of time and approach the experience of living in the present moment so elusive in ordinary hours. And the wonder of that experience, perhaps more than any other, seems to be at the very heart of the human desire to change consciousness, whether by means of drugs or any other technique. When I was training in Japan many years ago, one Zen temple, the Roshi there said, as you advance on the path, your memory goes. Now, to beginners, this could sound alarming. I've come to understand in my lifetime that this is a common fear among people, is losing their memory. And in extreme cases, there are grounds for that fear. But speaking as someone who has been at this a long time, I can say that there are definitely huge benefits to not clinging, because that's really what memory is, isn't it? It's a function of clinging, holding on. And so when we don't cling, we are able to live more fully in the present. And that's where all the action is, in the present. In fact, you could say that there is nothing but the present. There is no past except as it is recorded in the present, in newspapers or memory, or future. Future too is a concept and just consists of thoughts, speculations, ideas, plans. What one comes to learn through long practice is that you can find compensatory mechanisms for memory loss. You learn to write things down. Albert Schweitzer was once asked, when he had become a kind of a worldwide icon of humanitarianism and goodwill, he was asked by a reporter, what is happiness? And he said, happiness? That's nothing more than good health and a poor memory. Michael Pollan here quotes other famous names of singing the praises of living in the present rather than in the past. Nietzsche, an essay by Nietzsche from 1876 called The Uses and Disadvantages of History for Life. And he describes it as a moving and occasionally hilarious paean to the virtues of forgetting, which he maintains is a prerequisite to human happiness, mental health, and action. Without dismissing the value of memory or history, he argues, much like Emerson and Thoreau, that we spend altogether too much of our energy laboring in the shadows of the past, under the stultifying weight of convention, precedent, received wisdom, and neurosis. Like the American transcendentalists, Nietzsche believes that our personal and collective inheritance stands in the way of our enjoyment of life and accomplishment of anything original. And he quotes Nietzsche, cheerfulness, the good conscience, the joyful deed, confidence in the future, all of them depend on one's being just as able to forget at the right time as to remember. He admonishes us to cast off, quote, the great and ever greater pressure of what is past, and live instead rather more like the child that, quote, plays in blissful blindness between the hedges of past and future. Nietzsche acknowledges that there are perils to inhabiting the present. One is liable to falsely suppose all his experiences are original to him. But any loss in knowingness or sophistication is more than made up for by the gain in vigor. For Nietzsche, the art and power of forgetting consists in a kind of radical editing or blocking out of consciousness everything that doesn't serve the present purpose. A man seized by a vehement passion or great idea will be blind and deaf to all except that passion or idea. Everything he does perceive, however, he will perceive as he has never perceived anything before. And again, quoting Nietzsche, all is so palpable, close, highly colored, resounding, as though he apprehended it with all his senses at once. Then Pollan, what Nietzsche is describing is a kind of transcendence, a mental state of complete and utter absorption, well known to artists, athletes, gamblers, musicians, dancers, soldiers in battle, mystics, meditators, and the devout during prayer. Something very like it can occur during sex, too, while under the influence of certain drugs. Or while under the influence of certain drugs, or both. I was right. I suppose. It is a state that depends for its effect on losing oneself in the moment, usually by training a powerful, depthless concentration on one big thing. He capitalizes that, capital O-B-T, one big thing. And then he puts it, slips in here in parentheses, or in the Eastern tradition, one big nothing. If you imagine consciousness as a kind of lens through which we perceive the world, the drastic constricting of its field of vision seems to heighten the vividness of whatever remains in the circle of perception, while everything else simply falls away. A little bit more, and then. Some of our greatest happinesses arrive in such moments, during which we feel as though we've sprung free from the tyranny of time. Clock time, of course, but also historical and psychological time, and sometimes even mortality. So, I wasn't surprised when I heard the Roshi in Japan say this, that our memory goes as we advance on the path. Now, to be fair, it would be hard to tease apart advancing on the path with aging. We also, beyond middle age, we lose millions of brain cells every day. So there's that. But still, you could say that all of Zen practice, if you had to reduce it to a word, one response to that would be non-clinging, which enables us to be fully present, in touch, attuned to people and what's called for, and all of the sense, the pleasures of the senses. But now, this is an important little kind of stage whisper he puts in here. He says, not that this state of mind doesn't have its drawbacks. To name one, other people cease to matter. Now this is something we have to flag, because this is what distinguishes Buddhist practice from taking a drug. The meditation, daily meditation done for years, will enable us to live more and more fully in the moment. But that's just the pure meditation itself. What gives meaning or purpose or depth to this cognitive dysfunction is being part of this tradition that urges us to do this practice not just for our own pleasure, like smoking pot, but to do it in order to be able to help others, to serve others, to become vehicles of giving, service. Other people cease to matter. This is where, this is an absolutely huge distinction between smoking drugs or taking, smoking pot or taking some other drugs and the meditation. This came up in our symposium yesterday where a questioner asked the panel at the end of the day, posed this question to the panel. Do we think that there was one person, one of the speakers, Dr. James Austin, is a neurologist who had presented the sort of the brain workings of related to meditation. And this was directed to him, where they said, do you think someday we'll have something we can implant in the brain to bring about Kensho? And the point I made in response to that was, after Dr. Austin had responded, was that Zen practice, spiritual practice, not just Zen practice is not a matter of just trying to land in some altered state of consciousness that we can relish. That would be reducing it to just a drug-like altered state. And altered states anyway don't last forever. You know, when you come down from your high in marijuana, then you're down. It's gone. That's hardly what we're after with practice. But rather to realize our interdependence with all creatures and our connection to, yes, to the past and the future. In the Three Pillars of Zen, we're told that Harada Roshi in Japan, once in an introductory workshop, he drew on a chalkboard, he drew a vertical line and a horizontal line. And he said that this dot, where the intersection of these two lines, if you think of the vertical line as all of time, past and future, and the horizontal line as all of space, then each one of us stands at the intersection of these two. It's not that we are disconnected from past and future and other places and people. We are very much connected to all of that, all of them. And from that sense of connection comes a sense of responsibility. All beings without number, I vow to liberate. Memory and practice. I'm going to go on to another article here. And another aspect of this, this is from The New Yorker, September of 2007, by Oliver Sacks. The title is The Abyss, and he says, Music and Amnesia. This started off here. In March of 1985, Clive Waring, an eminent English musician and musicologist in his mid-40s, was struck by a brain infection, a herpes encephalitis, affecting especially the parts of his brain concerned with memory. He was left with a memory span of only seconds, the most devastating case of amnesia ever recorded. New events and experiences were effaced almost instantly. His wife, Deborah, wrote in a memoir in 2005, a memoir titled Forever Today. This is how she described it. His ability to perceive what he saw and heard was unimpaired, but he did not seem to be able to retain any impression of anything for more than a blink. Indeed, if he did blink, his eyelids parted to reveal a new scene. The view before the blink was utterly forgotten. Each blink, each glance away and back, brought him an entirely new view. I tried to imagine how it was for him, something akin to a film with bad continuity. The glass half empty, then full, the actor's hair now tousled, now smooth. Now, this would be the other extreme from our tendency to cling to the past. In addition to this inability to preserve new memories, Clive had a retrograde amnesia, a different kind of memory loss, a deletion of virtually his entire past. He was filmed in 1986. In 1986, he was filmed by Jonathan Miller in a documentary, Prisoner of Consciousness, in which he showed a desperate aloneness, fear, and bewilderment. He was acutely, continually, agonizingly conscious that something bizarre, something awful was the matter. His constantly repeated complaint, however, was not of a faculty memory, not of a faulty memory, but of being deprived in some uncanny and terrible way of all experience, deprived of consciousness and life itself. Deborah wrote, "It was as if every waking moment was the first waking moment. Clive was under the constant impression that he had just emerged from unconsciousness because he had no evidence in his own mind of ever being awake before. I haven't heard anything, seen anything, touched anything, smelled anything," he would say. "It's like being dead." Desperate to hold on to something, to gain some purchase, Clive started to keep a journal, first on scraps of paper, then in a notebook. But his journal entries consisted essentially of the statements, "I am awake," or "I am conscious," entered again and again every few minutes. He would write, 2:10 p.m., this time properly awake. 2:14 p.m., this time finally awake. 2:35 p.m., this time completely awake. Along with negations of these statements, quote, "At 9:40 p.m., I awoke for the first time, despite my previous claims." This, in turn, was crossed out, followed by, "I was fully conscious at 10:35 p.m. and awake for the first time in many, many weeks." This, in turn, was canceled out by the next entry. This dreadful journal, almost void of any other content but these passionate assertions and denials, intending to affirm existence and continuity, but forever contradicting them, was filled anew each day and soon mounted to hundreds of almost identical pages. It was a terrifying and poignant testament to Clive's mental state, his lostness in the years that followed his amnesia, a state that Deborah, in Miller's film, called a never-ending agony. Well, this is a fascinating article. It's quite long, and we're just going to pick up a couple things here. He spent 6.5 years in a mental institution. It was really a hellish period for him. But then 7 years after his illness, after huge efforts by Deborah, Clive was moved to a small country residence for the brain injured, much more congenial than a hospital. Here he was one of only a handful of patients and in constant contact with a dedicated staff who treated him as an individual and respected his intelligence and talents. He was taken off most of his heavy tranquilizers and seemed to enjoy his walks around the village and gardens near the home, the spaciousness, the fresh food. His wife reports that he's become more sociable, more talkative. He writes here, Sachs writes, Clive and Deborah are still very much in love with each other despite his amnesia. The subtitle of her book is A Memory of Love and Amnesia. He greeted her several times as if she had just arrived. It must be an extraordinary situation, I thought, both maddening and flattering, to be seen always as new, as a gift, a blessing. He describes in detail how this man coped with this. He found ways to keep a kind of a constant chatter going that Sachs saw as kind of stepping stones to help him relate to people. And he says here, I would use a phrase that Deborah used in another connection when she wrote of Clive being poised upon a tiny platform above the abyss. Clive's loquacity, his almost compulsive need to talk and keep conversations going, served to maintain a precarious platform, and when he came to a stop, the abyss was there, waiting to engulf him. Deborah thinks that repetition has slightly dulled the very real pain that goes with this agonized but stereotyped complaint. But when he says such things, she will distract him immediately. Once she's done this, there seems to be no lingering mood, an advantage of his amnesia. And indeed, once we return, an advantage of his amnesia. Now, here's where it gets interesting and a much more complex picture emerges. Remember, he was a musician, pianist, and as well as a musicologist. Back in his room, I spotted the two volumes of Bach's 48 Preludes and Fugues on top of the piano and asked Clive if he would play one of them. He said that he had never played any of them before, but then he began to play Prelude 9 in E major and said, "I remember this one." He remembers almost nothing unless he is actually doing it. Then it may come to him. He inserted a tiny, charming improvisation at one point and did a sort of Chico Marx ending with a huge downward scale. With his great musicality and his playfulness, he can easily improvise, joke, play with any piece of music. I asked him about prime ministers. Tony Blair? Never heard of him. John Major? No. Margaret Thatcher? Vaguely familiar. Harold Macmillan? Harold Wilson? Ditto. Deborah wrote of how he could not remember her name. Quote, "But one day someone asked him to say his full name, and he said, 'Clive David Deborah Waring.' Funny name, that. Don't know why my parents called me that." This is what Sachs calls implicit memories. He has gained other implicit memories too, slowly picking up new knowledge, like the layout of his residence. He can go alone now to the bathroom, the dining room, the kitchen, but if he stops and thinks en route, he is lost. Though he could not describe his residence, Deborah tells me that he unclasps his seatbelt as they draw near. Think of a dog, you know, in the back seat. They know as you're getting closer. He unclasps his seatbelt as they draw near and offers to get out and open the gate. Later, when he makes her coffee, he knows where the cups, the milk, and the sugar are kept. He cannot say where they are, but he can go to them. He has actions, but few facts at his disposal. Now, I'm going to relate this to the things we do need to remember just for now in terms of getting about in with practice and training in the Zendo and so forth. Sachs says, there are clearly many sorts of memory, and emotional memory is one of the deepest and least understood. He relates another case of another physician and with a patient. And then, it seems certain, likewise, that in the first 2 years of life, even though one retains no explicit memories, Freud called this infantile amnesia, deep emotional memories or associations are nevertheless being made in the limbic system and other regions of the brain where emotions are represented, and these emotional memories may determine one's behavior for a lifetime. At one of the Buddhist teachers' conferences that I went to, I met a Zen teacher who told me that in his first seven-day sesshin, he had the memory for the first time in his life of being beaten by his father when he was an infant. It was such an overwhelming experience for him that that's what caused him to become what he is now, a psychotherapist. He went into psychotherapy himself, and then you know, as with most Zen teachers, he has a day job and doesn't do it full time. Well, Sachs talks more about emotional memory, but I'm going to go on beyond that. Miller's film showed dramatically the virtually perfect preservation of Clive's musical powers and memory. In these scenes from only a year or so after his illness, his face often appeared tight with torment and bewilderment, but when he was conducting his old choir, he performed with great sensitivity and grace, mouthing the melodies, turning to different singers and sections of the choir, cueing them, encouraging them to bring out their special parts. Clive cannot retain any memory of passing events or experience, and in addition, has lost most of the memories of events and experiences preceding his encephalitis. How then does he retain his remarkable knowledge of music, his ability to sight read, play the piano and organ, sing and conduct a choir in the masterly way he did before he became ill? So then Sachs says there are two very different kinds of memory, a conscious memory of events, which he calls episodic memory, and an unconscious memory for procedures, and that such procedural memory is unimpaired in amnesia. He talks more about these things, Clive's ability to shave, shower, look after himself, dress elegantly, with taste and style. He moves confidently, is fond of dancing. He talks abundantly, using a large vocabulary. He can read and write in several languages. He can make phone calls. If he is asked how to do these things, he cannot say, but he does them. whatever involves a sequence or pattern of action he does fluently, unhesitatingly. So even for people who have concerns about some memory loss through practice, there's so much beyond that. He quotes a neuroscientist is using the term fixed action pattern for such procedural memories. So in other words, getting it into your body. Some of these may be present even before birth, he says. Fetal horses, for example, may gallop in the womb. That's an image, isn't it? Much of the early motor development of the child depends on learning and refining such procedures through play, imitation, trial and error, and incessant rehearsal. Clive's performance self seems, to those who know him, just as vivid and complete as it was before his illness. This mode of being, this self, is seemingly untouched by his amnesia, even though his autobiographical self, the self that depends on explicit episodic memories, is virtually lost. So here's the issue about the self, that it's not that we have no use for what we call a self. We can speak of having a self. We have a certain continuity to our personality and character. But what the problem, as understood in Buddhism, the problem with the self is the self as a narrative, as clinging to this notion of who we are. It's the notion that's the problem. We acquire the ability to function. That's the functional self. That's what we have to develop as children. We develop a sense of self and other. We need that functionally. But we don't need to hold on to our notions about who we are. And that's the self that we can do well without. It just causes us endless suffering. The self, in that sense, is nothing but thoughts of one kind or another, thought forms, memories, notions, associations, images of oneself. This is all just floating stuff that together in the aggregate we call the self. But we don't need it. We don't need to drag that around with us all the time. As most people do, it just gets in the way, it obstructs us, it gums up the works, it causes us endless distress and complications. It's a bit more here. He's again talking about more of this implicit memory, procedural memory. A piece of music will draw one in, teach one about its structure and secrets, whether one is listening consciously or not. This is so even if one has never heard a piece of music before. Listening to music is not a passive process, but intensely active, involving a stream of inferences, hypotheses, expectations, and anticipations. We can grasp a new piece, how it is constructed, where it is going, what will come next, with such accuracy that even after a few bars, we may be able to hum or sing along with it. When we remember, he puts remember in quotes, when we remember a melody, it plays in our mind, it becomes newly alive. So I think of chanting. And the value of memorizing a chant. Once we have memorized one of the sutras, the chants that we do, then we can throw ourselves into it with full animation and vitality. And it's interesting, there's this kind of momentum. I lost that here somewhere. It talks about the momentum of this kind of body memory. And I've always noticed that you can, even though one may be able to chant and hit every syllable in our chanting, like one of the long ones, the Japanese dharanis, the daishin, even though when it's in sequence from beginning to end, I find that I can hit every syllable. I know it through many years of doing it, thousands and thousands of times. If I have to pull a segment out of it, I have trouble. And I've heard from other people who have the same thing. Even the Hakuin chant, which is in English and much shorter, sometimes I have to labor to pull out just one line, because it's so much as a whole in within me. And then there's just the memory of the kind of body memory of bowing when we step in the zendo, bowing to the altar, the danger is that these things, that we can do these autonomically without presence of mind. And that's, we have to be aware to, yes, that we know just how to do it, but then while we're doing it, let's just do it with no mind, with a mind empty. Then that's when it has a great, great power to inspire us. To make a standing bow, hands palm to palm, to do this with nothing in the mind is one of the most eloquent expressions of gratitude and reverence that I can imagine. It's all there. It amuses me when people sometimes, as they're bowing, they're saying thank you. I know, I've done that too. It's you know, out of habit one can do that, but try silence as you're bowing. It has great power. Thus, we can listen again and again to a recording of a piece of music, a piece we know well, and yet it can seem as fresh, as new as the first time we heard it. There is not a process of recalling, assembling, recategorizing, as when one attempts to reconstruct or remember an event or a scene from the past. We recall one tone at a time, and each tone entirely fills our consciousness, yet simultaneously relates to the whole. It is similar when we walk or run or swim. We do so one step, one stroke at a time, yet each step or stroke is an integral part of the whole. Indeed, if we think of each note or step too consciously, this is what I was referring to, we may lose the thread, the motor melody. It may be that Clive, incapable of remembering or anticipating events because of his amnesia, is able to sing and play and conduct music because remembering music is not, in the usual sense, remembering at all. Remembering music, listening to it, or playing it is wholly in the present. Same with typing or anything like that, where if you were to ask a good typist, where is the D key, the person might not be able to say, because it's not held in the mind that way. It's already in the body and you don't need it in the mind. I find that the only pain I experience with memory loss is not being able to remember people's names. And I figure if someone is... So I've come to just make peace with saying, "Can you remind me of your name?" And if they have a big problem with that, then that's their problem. Here I have this living, breathing, utterly unique person, Buddha, standing in front of me. The fact that I can't hang the name on it seems pretty inconsequential to me. Of course, there are people who would say otherwise, who get offended if you can't remember their name. But I think beyond just forgetting names, we can do well without that kind of memory always intruding on our full experience of the moment. We'll stop now and recite the four vows.